Coming up on Philosophy Talk, minds and matter.
You know, minds are nothing but matter.
Sure, but what matter? You mean the brain, right?
No, an octopus's mind is distributed throughout its whole body.
Wow. I wonder what it's like to think like an octopus.
We're kidding ourselves if we think that questions like that have simple, direct answers at this stage, where we can just say, okay, these guys are conscious, these guys aren't. Where is my mind?
Where is my mind? Can an octopus ever know what it's like to be a bat?
Can humans ever know what it's like to be an octopus?
Could an octopus ever know what it's like to be you?
I think that our language begins to let us down when we start to look at the diversity of ways that animals live.
Our guest is Peter Godfrey Smith, author of Metazoa, Animal Life and the Birth of the Mind.
I really think the lights on, lights off thing is trouble.
Minds and matter.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
How did evolution first produce minds?
How can we tell which living things are conscious?
I mean, what would it be like to be a shrimp?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective living rooms via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about minds and matter.
You know, minds are a really weird thing. I mean, here we are, creatures of flesh and blood and atoms and stuff, but somehow we're having a conscious experience of the world. How does that happen?
Well, I hope you're not expecting me to solve the mind-body problem right here and now. But I think whatever the relationship is between our minds and our bodies, whether it's my mind or a shrimp's mind or whatever, they're both made of essentially the same stuff.
So you disagree with Descartes then? You don't think minds and matter are two fundamentally different substances?
Right. I just can't get behind Descartes. He thought minds are immaterial souls, pure consciousness, governed by reason. And he thought bodies are just physical stuff or matter, pushed and pulled around by natural forces.
Yeah, I mean, if minds and matter are so fundamentally different from each other, how are they supposed to interact?
Yeah, this is exactly the problem with Descartes' theory. And he never really came up with a satisfactory answer. He also had a really weird view of non-human animals and claimed they have no minds.
Oh, right. Yeah, what did he call them? Fleshy automata? Quick, cover Blossom's ears.
Oh, poor puppy. Oh, don't worry, Blossom. We're not talking about you. Descartes obviously never had any pets, or he would know that dogs and cats and birds and many other creatures really do have minds. They have lives that they experience. There's something it's like to be a dog and to live a dog's life.
Yeah, Descartes was definitely wrong about mammals and maybe some birds and some cephalopods like octopuses. But I don't know about fish or insects, let alone a whole host of simpler life forms. So don't you think fleshy automaton is a pretty good description of, say, I don't know, a fruit fly?
Wait, you don't think that fruit flies have minds? I didn't realize you were such an animal elitist. Fruit flies can navigate mazes and track a moving target. They're actually quite smart.
Well, yeah, and so is my phone. But that's not the same as being conscious. I mean, all life forms exhibit some kind of intelligence. Even plants. They sense where the sun is. They grow toward the light.
But plants don't have brains. And fruit flies do. Maybe insects don't have the same kind of rich mental lives that humans have, but who's to say there's not something it's like to experience the world the way a fruit fly does?
Ah, so you do have an answer to the mind-body problem. You said that plants don't have brains and fruit flies do. So clearly what you're saying is that what an animal needs for conscious experience is a brain.
Well, I don't know. Maybe a brain isn't necessary. Maybe you just need a nervous system of some sort.
So you think even creatures who don't have brains might still be conscious? Don't you think that's too generous? I mean, doesn't there need to be a certain level of biological complexity for conscious experience to be possible?
Well, yeah, complexity, sure. But why does it have to look like a brain? Maybe different minds evolved in different ways.
What do you mean?
Well, it's easy to see that animals like you, like chimps or whatever, have minds and inner lives. They're related to you.
Hey, what are you trying to insinuate?
Now look, they're my relatives too. We all evolved from similar ancestors. But there are all kinds of creatures with inner lives, including creatures that are completely different from us. Fruit flies, squids, tardigrades. Just because they're really distant cousins doesn't mean they can't have conscious experiences.
Well, you know what, Ray? I'll admit, you've really piqued my curiosity now. I think that's a genuinely exciting idea to learn more about the inner lives of animals who are distant from us on the evolutionary tree. Though, to be honest, I'm still not entirely convinced about fruit flies.
Well, I'm glad you've opened your mind, even if it's just a little. You'll be excited to hear that our guest this week is Peter Godfrey Smith, a philosopher who spends a lot of time underwater observing, and sometimes interacting with, all sorts of weird and wonderful sea creatures.
I can't wait. But in the meantime, we humans love to rank which animals we think are the smartest. And if you do a quick search, you're probably going to find corvids, the family of birds that includes crows, ravens, and magpies, up there in the top five.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shireen Adil, to find out more about their cognitive capabilities. She files this report.
So where are we right now?
So we're at 15th and Franklin.
Okay, and we're looking west, right?
We're looking west. We're looking towards Civic Center, towards City Hall.
I'm here with Adrian Cotter. He started a project about 5 years ago mapping out raven's nests in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today, we're scouting them out in the heart of downtown Oakland.
If you look up, it's the white and brick building near the top. And in that corner, there's a nest in there on that ledge.
Adrian started looking for raven's nests after he saw a pair of birds and their young on the Federal Building in San Francisco.
It was totally something I wouldn't have expected. I wouldn't have expected ravens to be making nests on buildings.
When he did a little more exploring, he discovered that crows and ravens actually thrive in urban environments. So far, he's found over 100 raven's nests in San Francisco alone.
I've been all over the city.
In the last 50 years, corvid populations in cities have grown a ton. In the 70s, the Golden Gate Audubon Society only counted a few dozen crows in the Bay Area, and ravens were a rare sight. Since 2010, though, they've counted over 1,000 crows every year and hundreds of ravens. So why are these birds flocking to cities?
Because we've created this wonderful habitat for them.
Not only do they make nests in our buildings, they also like to eat our garbage. But they're not like other urban birds. They're also really smart about it. They store their food and make it really hard for other animals to find.
So they'll often like fake putting things in places. There's definitely like awareness of how other things think about what they're doing.
Crows and ravens also recognize human faces. If you piss them off, they'll harass you. And if you give them food, they'll find things to give you in return. Like this one story Adrian told me about a little girl who accidentally dropped crumbs for crows on her way in and out of her house.
And like the next day she was there, the crow brought her a gift.
So she started to leave them more food and collected the gifts they brought her. Her name is Gabby Mann, and she was asked about it in a podcast called The Bittersweet Life.
What is this that we're looking at?
It's kind of like a keychain, and this is a heart from them. It's showing me how much they love me.
When crows interact with us and the world we live in, we study them and we see familiar behavior. They make tools, they play with each other. Crows are social creatures, and it's easy to think maybe they are self-aware, just like us. But one thing is for sure, they have a unique ability to adapt their lives to our world.
That's Russell Crowe, Cameron Crowe, Crow Diddley, Hume Cronin, Gregory Peck.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shireen Adil.
Thanks so much for that fascinating report, Shireen. I'm Josh Laddy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about minds and matter.
We're joined now by Peter Godfrey Smith, professor in the School of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney, and author of Metazoa, Animal Life and the Birth of the Mind. Peter, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be back. Last time I was on the show a long time ago, it was with Ken Taylor and John Perry. And it's very sad that Ken has passed away, and it's great that you are continuing the Philosophy Talk tradition.
Thanks so much for saying that. We miss Ken every day, you know, not just on the show, but in our daily lives. So I really appreciate you mentioning that, Peter. You know, Peter, I know from personal experience that you love to go deep sea diving. You even took me on a dive in Australia once in shark-infested waters, which was fantastic. So was there some particular encounter you had in the water one time that first inspired you to do this research?
The most important encounter was actually right near where you and I were, Josh, the same little bay. That was the first place where I came across an Australian giant cuttlefish. It's an amazing animal, 3 feet long, changing colors continually. It wasn't the first time I'd seen one, but it was the first time that I had this strong impression you can have with them that it's not just that the diver, you know, that I was interested in the animal, but the animal seemed to be interested in me. There was a kind of reciprocal engagement, and that really changed my thinking about animals of this kind.
Wow. So what would you say is one of the most interesting or surprising things you've discovered in your research about animal lives?
The thing that for me is most surprising, I can't really call it a discovery because it's just the picture I now have, the view I've ended up with. And I think a lot of people, various people have a related view. This is the idea that rather than subjective experience or consciousness in a broad sense, the ability to feel one's life, rather than that coming into being in a kind of single evolutionary invention, there were probably multiple paths, independent pathways that got animals to a situation like that. Now, how many pathways? I can't answer that exactly. A figure like 3 would not be a crazy figure to give, maybe 4 or 5. The picture we're getting is one in which there's a range of animals, a pretty small range, that became very behaviorally complex and that acquired senses that feed action and action that feeds senses in ways that I think are sufficient for experience. And that kind of ability in animals arose not once, but roughly something like 3, 4, or 5 times, where the 3 conspicuous versions are seen in animals like us, vertebrates and birds and so on. Also in some arthropods, the animals that include insects and crustaceans, and this one strange group of cephalopods, well, one strange group of mollusks, the cephalopods, the group that includes the octopus and that giant cuttlefish.
So the insects and the cephalopods, what are the major differences between the way that they're conscious and the way that we're conscious?
Well, that's asking a very hard question. in the book Metazoa, I try to make a little headway on that question. But I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that questions like that have simple, direct answers at this stage, where we can just say, okay, these guys are conscious, these guys aren't. The awareness of this kind of animal is like this, and the awareness of that kind of animal is like that. I don't think we're at that stage. I think we're at a stage where a variety of different kinds of evidence are being pieced together to give a general picture of, roughly speaking, who's got it, although I'd like to revisit the form of that question in a little while, perhaps. And some features and some aspects of, who's got what kind of experience. In the case of insects and cephalopods or arthropods more generally and cephalopods, you can say some things about their bodies and lifestyles that I think give us some clues. Cephalopods, or at least octopuses, some octopuses and some others like cuttlefish, they're very exploratory, inquisitive sorts of animals. They attend to novelty in many cases. They have a kind of engagement with new things.
I do that too.
They have a kind of engagement with new things, which is very distinctive. And their lives don't have the kind of routine that you see in the lives of a lot of insects and other arthropods, where you've got a list of things to do in your life, a short life in which to get through these things, and everything has to be done in a very kind of organized, routinized way, for the most part, not everything, but many things. And you have a body built to serve the particular task that you face. There's a kind of acute sensory motor ability and skill in arthropods, which is a little different in my favorite cephalopods, but a kind of openness of you know, orientation to things, an interest in novelty, which I think of as distinctive to octopuses in particular, and to some extent, some other cephalopods.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about minds and matter with Peter Godfrey Smith from the University of Sydney.
How can you tell if a creature you encounter has a mind? Are brains required for subjective experience? Can something be intelligent without being conscious?
Minds, brains, and experience, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. Sailing away in search of intelligent life in the oceans. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about minds and matter with Peter Godfrey Smith from the University of Sydney, author of Metazoa, Animal Life and the Birth of the Mind.
We're still pre-recording episodes from home, and we can't take your phone calls at this present moment, but you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So Peter, you've looked at a lot of unusual animals in the ocean, and you've studied a lot of early life forms. How do you know when you found a creature that has a mind?
I don't think we can yet just know when we've found it, except in the obvious cases, or the relatively obvious cases, animals very close to us. When I'm looking at invertebrates and trying to work out what might be going on inside them, it's always a pretty provisional matter. I'm trying to sort of piece together the various lines of evidence and work out what's a reasonable picture. In the case of cephalopods, octopuses and their relatives, that kind of attentiveness and engagement with novelty, I think of as a rather good piece of evidence. Even people who think that a lot of what animals can do can be done automatically, unconsciously. People like Stanislas Dehaene, the French neuropsychologist whose work I admire very much, he thinks that dealing with novelty, in producing novel behaviors in response to novel things, is something that in humans is never done unconsciously. So when I see that in octopuses, I regard that as good evidence in their case.
So it seems like there's a lot of different features we might be thinking of when we ask the question, does this organism have a mind? Is it intelligent? Is it conscious? So there's you talked about inquisitiveness, interest in novelty. Sometimes people talk about integration of sensory data. Or I know you and your book talk about a sense of a differentiation between oneself and the environment, right? That if something changes the environment, it might be because you did it as opposed to just something happened out there. There's like behavioral flexibility, ability to plan. Like which of these things are most central, do you think, for marking the difference between like a rock and an organism that is conscious?
Well, to some extent, they come together as a package, and the animal way of being in the world, the kind of the form of life that animals have, to a large part, not entirely, but in many, many cases, involves agency, doing things, getting things done, moving through the world, dealing with sensory information in a way that enables you to respond to it in a way that makes sense, and integration of sensory streams is part of what makes that possible. Responding to events with a kind of tacit sense of self versus other is another thing that makes that possible. A number of the things you were talking about, I think, do come together as a package. Now, if you try to pull them apart and ask which ones are central, this is the point, or one of the points, at which I think we should move to asking the whole question in a slightly different way. So I don't think the presence of experience or consciousness, felt consciousness, is a kind of yes or no, on-off thing. I think evolutionarily, it just can't be that way. Evolution doesn't build complicated things in a way that has that kind of light switch-like on versus off character. So in the past, there must have been lots of partial cases, marginal cases, gray area type cases. And It's then also natural to think that when we look around us, especially at invertebrates, various kinds of mollusks and arthropods, we're also looking at creatures that have partial or gray area type cases. And partial cases of many different forms. So I think that our language, when we talk about experience being just present or absent, begins to let us down. It begins to be insufficient when we start to look at the diversity of ways that animals live.
So, question about the partial cases. Do you think that there are instances where humans, maybe humans that are like usually what we think of as like fully conscious in their lives, experience the lights kind of being partly on and partly off? I'm having trouble imagining what it could be like.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's not, I mean, some kinds of waking from sleep have a bit of that character. And whenever often when I say that in discussions with other philosophers, they just don't buy it. They think that when you're waking with sleep, there has to be a moment at which, in a kind of faint but real way, the lights are on, and a moment before that where there's just no experience at all. To me, maybe I'm just a sort of dozy sort of person, but it doesn't feel like that at all. So in a very, very rough, imperfect way, waking from sleep provides, I think, a little bit of an analogy for thinking about these cases. I mean, only a very partial one.
I totally agree. I think your friends clearly haven't read Proust. Yeah, I think you just read the first page of Proust.
Right, right.
There you have it, right? Right? You know, there's lots of gradations. So, there's that joke about, you can't be a little bit pregnant. But I think you make a convincing case you can be a little bit conscious, and human beings can be too. But where do you draw that line? Like, what about plant life? Is there something it's like to be a petunia? Do plants have inner worlds in this way? Are they conscious even a little bit? Is the light a little bit on for plants, or is it all the way off?
The shape of a view that I think we might end up with is one in which there are yes cases, us, there are no cases, rocks, for example, and there are cases where it's not that the light is on but a little bit, it's that there's something in there that's partially akin to the light being on. You know, the internal processes are partly experiential and partly not. I really think the lights on, lights off thing is trouble. And then in the case of plants, the question might be, are they squarely in the no side with the rocks, or are there internal processes that have a kind of very faint, partially experiential nature? Now, I don't know the answer to that. Until pretty recently, I would have said, oh, yes, they're just going to be nose. They don't have a nervous system. And also, they don't have the kind of integration as a kind of whole agent-like being that animals have, and that I think is very important. With plants, surprises keep coming in, and I've become a little bit more cautious about them than I used to be. But especially kind of surprises in what they can sense and in the electrical activity within them. But roughly speaking, I still have plants on the no side.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about minds and matter with Peter Godfrey Smith, author of Metazoa, Animal Life and the Birth of the Mind. And Peter, we've got some email for you. I think the first two emails pair really well together. So I'll read you one and Josh can read you the other, and then you can have a chance to respond to them. So the first email is from Dr. Caffeine, who's a biomedical scientist, and writes, "It is increasingly clear that the mind is a function of the matter we and other animals are made of. The philosophical era of reification leaves us with the strong impression that this function or process is a kind of ghost, spark, or spirit that is somehow running our thinking and acting. Dressing up this vitalist idea remains a categorical error. How we function, the processes of life, are amazing enough. There's no need, no requirement, for an extra entity to account for our life and process associated with it. Matter is all that matters."
But the countervailing email from Kane says, "No, minds are not brains." As though replying to Dr. Caffeine, it's so lovely. "No, minds are not brains. Leibniz's law of identity states that two things are the same if they have the same properties. Since mental content and neurotransmitter electrical pulses are not made of the same material, we cannot say they are the same thing." So who's right, Peter?
Well, I side mostly with the first. The only The only point at which I'd sort of hesitate is concerns whether it really just is a kind of error of reification, whether we're turning something that's not really a thing into a thing and being misled and messing up our picture of the world as a consequence. To say that that's the problem is to say that we could get over this and everything would be fine, not very puzzling, if we just spoke a little bit differently about things. And I think there are some distortions in the way that we think about the problem, but I don't think we can get over it just by, you know, avoiding errors of reification and the like. I think it is genuinely surprising and puzzling in some ways that the activity of material things, our brains essentially, is sufficient for experience. I think it is genuinely surprising, and we have to learn some new things, alter our picture of what the physical is like to some extent for everything to sort of fall into place. I do think we'll learn those things. So I side with the first email rather than the second. Perhaps I have a bit more of a sense of a difficult problem than the writer of the first email.
Yeah, I mean, there is that famously hard problem, right? There's that lovely line from John Locke: it's impossible to conceive that ever bearing cognitive matter should produce a thinking intelligent being. And I take it your thought is, well, that doesn't mean we have to go all Descartes and posit some kind of bodiless mind out there. But what is the answer? I mean, is it, some people talk about the mind as an emergent property, right? So it's sort of, it's constrained by the properties of the brain, but it's not reducible completely to the brain. So, but what is it for you, Peter? How, if there isn't this magical mind substance, what is the right way of thinking about the relationship?
I don't much like the concept of emergence. A lot of people do, and I can see the temptation for sort of general philosophical reasons. I think of it as a bit unhelpful. There's also a tendency one can have towards talking about the mind as a kind of product of what the brain does, as something made, experiences something made by the brain. And it just can't be that way, I think. It has to be that once you have activity of a certain kind within a brain, within an animal of a certain kind, that activity is a mind, it is experience. And experience is just that kind of activity as experience, you know, well, as felt from the first person point of view. A mind is the first person point of view on a certain kind of neural activity. So part of what we have to sort of make progress, I think, on is thinking and talking clearly about these relationships between first person and third person points of view. The point of view where we describe what's present or see what's present in a brain, and a point of view we have when we are a brain of that kind. Part of it is that. I think part of it is rethinking, to some extent, our view of what kind of thing a brain is and what kind of activity goes on inside them. I do think there are some shifts necessary there. And the other part is the side of the issue pursued in a book like Metazoa, the kind of evolutionary approach, where we talk about the way that being an agent is a characteristic of animal life. And putting it roughly, subjectivity comes along with agency of a certain kind. Explaining subjective experience is partly explaining what it is to be an agent and how agents came to exist in evolution.
Peter, I'm wondering, I have a little bit of a puzzle for you and a proposal about maybe how to fix it. So you say that the mind is nothing over and above the brain, but you also say that an octopus, an insect, and I, all three of us have minds. And I'm wondering how to reconcile these things, because my brain is like my brain and not like an octopus's brain. An octopus doesn't have a brain like mine, but an octopus is like me insofar as it has a mind. And that's a little strange, because how can my mind be the same as my brain if my brain is not like what's in an octopus and my mind is like what's in an octopus? And so I thought maybe a useful metaphor for this is that it's like the relationship between the mind and the brain is a little like the relationship between boiling water and the placement of individual molecules in a pot of boiling water. So in some sense, the boiling of the water is nothing over and above what happens to the individual molecules. But in another sense, they're different because you could boil the water with all the molecules being in different places and some different boiling configuration and still have boiling water. Do you think that's a good metaphor?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I think it's quite helpful, actually. You've got the boiling, which looks like, you know, it's got a name, which is different from the name you give to the sort of the object which is doing the boiling. The boiling is its own thing, and it's an activity that has some apparent independence from the molecular details of the pot of water. But once you've got the molecules doing their thing, you've got the boiling. There's nothing extra. There's no need to add anything to our picture of what the world contains. So I think that analogy is a rather good one for handling these questions.
So this makes me wonder about just a cool organism that I wanted to hear your thoughts on, which is the tunicate, which are a kind of invertebrate that spends the beginning of their life able to move and swim around, and then later in life attaches themselves to a rock and sort of digests their own brain and stops moving. Do you have any thoughts on what's going on with the mind of a tunicate? Like, does it have a mind that it slowly loses, or maybe we can't know?
Right. I don't know enough about tunicate biology to say anything very, very definite on that point. I will happily, however, set the record straight on one thing. So philosophers especially like the story in which when a tunicate settles and stops swimming around and attaches to a rock, it digests its own brain, or, you know, eats its own nervous system. There's a paper by George Mackey and a collaborator about tunicate neuroscience, where they react with some indignation towards this this anecdote and say it's not true that a tunicate retains a perfectly good nervous system, just one more suited to a sort of quiet life than the form it had when it was swimming. And it's a decent-sized nervous system, Mackey emphasizes. So whereas philosophers have long relished the story of the animal that settles down and eats its brain, unfortunately, it's not as true as I and others thought it was.
We like it because we think it applies to us. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about minds and matter with Peter Godfrey-Smith from the University of Sydney, author of Metazoa, Animal Life and the Birth of the Mind.
Do fish feel pain? Can lobsters have bad moods? What does that mean about how we should treat them?
The moral status of animals, plus commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. You gotta come and see what's happening with conscious minds at the zoo. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Peter Godfrey-Smith from the University of Sydney, and we're thinking about minds and matter.
So Peter, you've been talking in very interesting ways about ways in which you've changed your mind, or at least become less certain about this and that. Has your thinking changed at all about how we should treat non-human animals as you've learned more about their lives and experiences?
Yeah, it has changed. The immediate change is I have a sense of there being a lot more experience around in the world than I thought there was before. And a lot more experience that has at least the beginnings of some moral relevance. To pick a really dramatic case, a case that's hard to think about, for a long while I thought that insects, ordinary land insects in particular, probably had a form of subjective experience that's quite rich on the sensory side, but they probably, I thought, did not feel pain or anything like pain, and didn't have the particular kinds of experience that trigger interest from a moral philosophy point of view. I think the evidence is growing that insects may well feel a form of pain, or if they don't feel a form of pain, they may feel emotion-like or mood-like states that can be positive or negative, that can have that kind of that kind of relevance that makes welfare questions take a certain form. And what to think in response to that is quite hard. I mean, it was, I think, initially hard for some people to get used to the idea to the extent that people have got used to it, that there's very good evidence that fish feel pain. I think there's not a whole lot of doubt about that now. Octopuses also, and a growing list of invertebrates. Once you include insects, you know, we're surrounded by this endless carnage of these short lives of vast numbers of insects. Trying to work out exactly how to make an adjustment in the way that we behave is quite difficult. These ideas have confirmed me in my thinking that practices like factory farming of animals are really abhorrent, and we just need to move away from many modern forms of farming. I've become far more skeptical about the appropriateness of using animals like, especially animals like monkeys and cats, in invasive biological experiments. So I think there's cases like that where there's real immediate pressure. And then there's a kind of an enormous class of cases where it's hard to know exactly how to think about the situation, where many invertebrates fall into that second category.
Yeah, so one thing that occurs to me about invertebrates is that we don't farm them mostly. I guess we sometimes farm oysters, but even shrimp, I think a lot of them are just wild caught. And that leads me to wonder about, like, is it good for them that they exist? So one kind of very nihilist view you could have is, like, it's bad for the insects that they have to go through so much pain, and so we should try to prevent their existence. I don't buy that with people. So I don't know why I would buy it with insects, but it right. Blows my mind.
Shrimp farming is quite a good case to think about. And shrimp farming is now a big thing. I don't have the figures in front of me, but I think roughly something like half of the shrimp that get eaten now are farmed rather than wild caught, especially farmed in Asia. And that's a good case to think about, because I think there's reasonable evidence that shrimp can feel pain and other aversive states. I think they probably have I would rather be a wild shrimp who is caught than a farmed shrimp. I think aquaculture of animals like that, there tends to be very dense packing. There tends to be lots of disease problems and things like that. Fish farming, I think, is looking like it's, in many cases, not a good thing. Jennifer Jacquet from NYU has written a number of interesting pieces on this topic, arguing that we should be farming shellfish a whole lot more, not be farming octopus, not be farming fish, or at least not in anything like the ways that we're beginning to do now. And I think those are good arguments. I think shellfish, bivalves, clams, oysters, mussels, and things are a really good candidate, although some of them are in that gray area that I spend a lot of time thinking about.
Peter, I have to say, you know, since that wonderful day when we went out together and saw an octopus, I haven't come anywhere near such a thing on a plate. And I'm convinced by you that we should extend this to other beings and you know, stop doing experimenting on a number of organisms that we're currently experimenting on. I have a slightly different version of this question. You were thinking about non-human animals as victims of our predation or other practices. What about non-human animals as moral agents? Like, there was a lovely experiment whose headline was "Rats Forsake Chocolate to Save a Drowning Companion," which makes me think, I don't know what I would forsake chocolate for. But so it seems like maybe there are some cases in the non-human world of animals acting morally. Is that the right way to talk about that?
I think probably not the right way to talk about it, but I haven't thought about this problem, this question very much. I've not seen that rat study. In the case of some animals, you do seem to have a tacit sense of behavioral norms, where if an animal transgresses or breaks a behavioral norm, there's a response, there's retaliation, where this need not be a purely self-interested response by the animal who is responding. I hesitate at the export of the idea of moral agency and its associated notions of moral responsibility into the non-human realm. I guess I do think of this as a human thing. You know, moral agency is a human thing, but that doesn't mean that we should regard non-human animals as just sort of outside of the realm of moral concern.
So I also wonder sort of, so there's the low-hanging fruit of like, we shouldn't factory farm animals if we have other sources of food, which we do. But how much else do we owe animals? So I'm thinking in particular sort of zoo animals and companion animals, we could give them a life that's not full of miserable suffering, but that seems like it might not be enough if we don't give them rich and beautiful lives. What do you think our responsibilities are toward those kinds of animals?
Right. I'm not against companion animals at all. I think having companion animals is fine if you give them a good life. And I think we can give them wonderful lives. We could also give them terrible lives in some cases. So it's not that it's always okay. And neither is it enough, just as you indicated, to merely give them a sort of barely tolerable life. We should be doing better than that. But the idea that there's something intrinsically wrong with having pets, with having cats and dogs and things like that, even when they're treated very well, I think is sort of going too far. I think of that as a mistake. Zoos, I am uneasy about. If it wasn't for their importance, which is becoming a very great importance in enabling endangered species to stay alive, I mean, breeding programs that zoos engage in to help species continue through the risks, which I hope are temporary, of habitat destruction, the work they're doing is often very important. And I would hesitate to be sort of very anti-zoo for that reason. They do make me uneasy, though, I have to admit.
Peter, we're getting towards the end of our time here, and I don't want to let you go without asking you a question about how beautiful and enchanting your research is. You know, people think of science as being disenchanting ever since Keats and others, and you know, there's something to that. But these are incredible illuminations and mysteries that you're uncovering here. And I guess my question is something like, okay, maybe we don't want to be total Cartesians and believe in this sort of mysterious soul substance. But couldn't there be something a bit sort of weird going on? Weird and wonderful, right? I mean, science already has room for quantum physics, which is, you know, a part of physical reality that's blisteringly weird. Why couldn't another part of physical reality also be blisteringly weird? I mean, this gradual light coming in, it's not an on-off switch, but gradual illumination of organisms as they move through evolution. It's not outside of the physical, but isn't it something a bit special?
I'm with you on the embrace of weirdness here. I think that part of what has made the mind-body problem look so hard to philosophers recently, you know, over the last few decades, is they've had a very kind of dry picture of the physical. They've had a picture of the physical world as being sort of bare bones in a sense, the sort of dry structural relationships. And even though they philosophers know officially that there's much in the world that's not mechanical, push-pull, impact-based, they still have a very kind of mechanical conception of matter when they think about the mind-body problem. I think that the physical world is much weirder than that. I think that brains are weirder than that. One of the things that was a sort of major real discovery for me when writing Metazoa was realizing the oddity and the importance of these large-scale electrical rhythms and oscillations in our brains, not just our brains in the sense of human brains, but the brains and nervous systems of a great many animals. That's weird. And the guy who originally discovered these oscillations and these sort of these electrical rhythms, Hans Berger, he thought it showed ESP. I mean, he had a truly spooky view of what he was investigating, and he was looking into it because he was very interested in very unorthodox views of that kind. Now, I don't think we've worked out that brains are the kinds of things that will, in virtue of these electrical properties, enable ESP, but they're pretty weird. They're a long way from a kind of inert or sort of merely responsive signaling network in the way that people sometimes imagine in this context.
Hooray for rational spookiness. Peter, that has been a lot of wonderful matter for our minds. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Our guest has been Peter Godfrey-Smith, professor in the School of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney and author of Metazoa, animal life and the birth of the mind. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, I've really enjoyed thinking about all the different kinds of minds that are actual and possible. And another place I like to go to explore different kinds of possible minds is science fiction, where you have authors like Anne Leckie in the Ancillary Sword trilogy, imagining what it would be like to have a group mind, or Octavia Butler in the Xenogenesis trilogy, imagining the minds of aliens who operate very differently from us and maybe commune with plants and have also a group mind, or the explorations of Greg Egan, who imagines what a really advanced machine mind would look like. So I think that all of those imaginings can help us think about what's possible in addition to animals.
Those are brilliant suggestions. I would add Le Guin's short stories, Watership Down. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a conundrum that's bedeviling you, a personal dilemma in your life that might benefit from philosophical insight, send it to us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. And maybe we can think through it together on the air.
Now, the fastest mind on two legs, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, consciousness is not a thing like an appendix or an extra thumb, more like a living ghost in the flesh that gathers information from our senses and blunders on. Some theories say that consciousness evolved from instinct, kind of. Don't touch, you can cut yourself on that thing. That thing tastes bad. Intelligence began with avoidance of pain. Consciousness came from gauging differences. Is that hot enough to touch? Is it too hot to eat? Can I have sex with that? If I put that in my head, will I look good or silly? Our days are filled with these decisions, which we often make with assured confidence, even though we don't know where these decisions originate. What is the mind? Is consciousness merely a symptom of neurology? Even if it's all just in our mind, is it any less real? Personally, I have no doubt that we'll be found to have some kind of physical reality like light, noise, and nameless dread. I know that I am conscious, but as David Chalmers showed in his thought experiment, everybody else could be zombies, programmed to act like they are conscious. They could be psychopaths who have learned to mimic human behavior, but really have no human qualities other than appetite and charm. We pride ourselves on our thinking ability, but we're insecure about it. We have Turing tests to make sure our computers aren't really us. We make movies and books about robots getting smarter and more human than we are. Also, there's the downside to consciousness. Obsessions, nightmares, why do we have them? What do they mean? We invented the wheel, central heating, ovens, light bulbs, cars, and theories about how the mind works. On the other hand, we have dreams, poetry, drunk driving. We have superstitions, religions, weird personal habits, foibles, fanatical beliefs. We have strange conspiracy theories. The Kennedy assassination cluster was the big one for ages, but may soon be eclipsed, I believe, by the Trump years. Trump did not seem to engender conspiracy theories about himself because he's pretty transparent. He is what he is, as the kids say. Conspiracies against him were another story, though. He said he had the largest crowd ever, to take one example. Clearly, that wasn't true. But if he pointed that out, he became part of the dark forces aligned against Trump from the beginning. So facts, data, evidence became suspect. The internet helped. When newspapers went away, social media jumped in to give everything equal weight, from atrocities to kittens. People who used to self-publish their theories or leave single-spaced essays on the laundromat bulletin board now found their tribe in chat groups and Facebook and the Twitter. Suddenly, QAnon sense was just common sense to millions. Any attempt to call out disinformation was itself disinformation. The dragons warned of by the ancient sea maps turned out to be not real exactly, but real enough to put all our faith in Donald Trump to steer us through those waters, so we thought of him as a straight shooter who also lies every time he opens his mouth. White-collar crime entered a new golden age. Suckers, corruption, bribery, confidence gains, fraud, trickle-down economics, the old saying, if it's too good to be true, it probably isn't, which was invented whole cloth by our thinking brain, is no longer listened to. We're marching maskless through infectious air as the world catches fire and we yammer on about it all being a hoax by a deep state pedophile ring with links to Hollywood, the media, and the Democratic Party. Actual children, by the way, over 500 still, separated at the southern border from their parents by the actual U.S. government, remain separated. Their actual missing parents still at large. Where is QAnon on this? I'm wondering if evolution might not work in reverse. We're losing our ability to think, and instinct soon will also leave us. Go back from avoiding fire and just walk confidently right into the flames. Asbestos be damned. Causes cancer, you know. No mask. We want our freedom. Back to our natural state. Kind of like entropy, which in humanity's case is on fire and screaming. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
What if an octopus Adam and Eve brought sin to their world? Would they be saved by a human Jesus or an octopus Jesus?